Shamim Akhtar, her husband Naeem Ali Khan, and her four children, one of which is Canadian-born, face deportation to Karachi, Pakistan. They are Shia Muslims who were forced to flee Pakistan and have been living in Montreal since February of 2002. Shamim's children are star students, fluent in French and English, and hopeful of living a peaceful life here in Canada where they feel safe. Here, we will look at their situation and their case in great detail.
They just showed us a little beam of light and then suddenly they took it away.
You know, I'm not the fight, but you know, I'm just asking, please, you didn't give me the deportation orders. Just request.
I had a chance to speak with Shamim Akhtar about her upcoming deportation date and also the dangers her and her family face if they go back to Karachi, Pakistan. You came to Canada from Karachi, Pakistan,
yes,
in February of 2002. Maybe you could explain why you left Pakistan.
Because I'm Muslim, Shia Muslim, and over there is not for safe my family life and my life in Pakistan, Karachi, all Pakistan. That's why I'm coming here.
What is the danger that Shia Muslims are facing in Pakistan?
You know, in Pakistan is a SSP terrorist group and a big group. And just the problem created and many people he killed day for yesterday. Day for yesterday is in Shia Muslim in my mosque. Because I'm Shia, over there is a Shia's problem over there.
What happened to your family that made you want to leave Karachi?
It's just killing my family. Oh, the SSP Sipa Sahaba group is killing my family, all family. It's my four children and me and my husband. It's killing my family.
When you first arrived in Canada, What did you expect coming here?
Yeah, it's better life. I'm go everywhere. I'm go to my mosque and my husband, my children, everybody goes. You know, it's mentally free here. It's very good life here, and I'm happy. My children is happy. My husband is happy here. But now he's not happy.
What do you think the danger would be if you went back to Pakistan right now?
Yeah, it's too dangerous. Just not dangerous, it's too dangerous. Too many, you know, over there is in Karachi, in Pakistan. It's 8th of May. It's bomb blasting for my mosque. Imam Barga, Hadri Imam Barga, many people is killed over there. And just day for 2-3 days before is bomb blasting again. And too many people killed over there in Ali Raza Imam Barga, in Shia Mosque.
You applied for refugee status in August of 2002, but were denied that status. Why did the judge deny your refugee status then?
Just my judge say, yeah, I know, I accept you as a Shia Muslim. She agree. She say, yeah, I'm agree. You are Shia Muslim family. I didn't question for the religion because I know you Shia Muslim. But you're my husband. My judge say your Naeem Ali is not active member in Pakistan. My husband said, no, I'm active member, because it's before my hearing, 2-3 days, is a big happen for Karachi too and Quetta too. He says that many people killed, 7 years old is one boy over there is killed. It's not active member. He said, no, over there is everything is good. Parvez Musharraf 2002 is banned for Sipa Sahaba. He says Pakistan is now is good.
Do you feel that the judge's decision was fair?
No, not fair. Not good for judge. He gave me the good decision. He didn't have the heart, you know, is my judge. He didn't have a heart. He didn't have the children. He didn't have the husband. He didn't have maybe. He didn't have the family. Because he have the family, he have the children. He didn't give me the... It's a bad answer. He didn't have the children.
According to BBC News, sectarian violence between Sunni and Shia Muslims has killed as many as 4,000 people in Pakistan in the last 4 years. Shia Muslims, who are the minority in the country, often fall victim to attacks at the hands of Sunni extremists and terrorist groups such as the Sipah-e-Sahaba or the SSP. President Pervez Musharraf banned the SSP in 2003. But it remains obvious, even to Canadian authorities, that they are still largely active in Pakistan. Just over the last month, we have witnessed many terrorist attacks on Shia Muslims, including suicide bombings in mosques, killing at least 18 in one case.
This is a countrywide phenomenon. There is no part of the country where you will not find it. Violence by Sunni extremists against the Shia minority at some point in time. This is not a new situation at all. What makes it unique is that the government, in many, many cases, have taken a decision denying reality. Now they have to look at the events that are going on now and ask themselves some hard questions about whether they can even convince themselves that that's the case. Right now, to send Shia back to Pakistan in the current state of affairs, where a group that a recent Supreme Court Justice of Canada said the government claims to be tackling terrorism and has taken almost no steps toward restricting the extremism that permeates parts of society.
That was David Chalk, the lawyer for the Akhtar family. We will now hear from Harsha Walia of No One Is Illegal in Montreal. Here she will speak to the political climate in Pakistan and to the situation of Pakistani refugees living in Montreal and in Canada. Maybe to start off, you could just kind of speak to the situation of Pakistanis here in Canada and in Montreal.
Okay. In terms of Montreal, it's hard to say how many people are facing deportation because the Pakistani refugee community in Montreal is the largest one. As far as we know, there's deportations that occur weekly. So the Action Committee has about 100 to 200 active members, but people are constantly being deported on a daily basis. Last week, there was 200 Pakistanis who were called in en masse to receive deportation orders on the weekend. Most of the refugees in Montreal have actually made their way through the United States over the past couple of years. Since 9-1-1 specifically, because after 9-1-1 there was the registrations, the deportations, the detentions, the racial profiling. So a lot of them have made their way through the states across the border in 2002, 2003, when all the turnbacks were happening. And the Action Committee has, I mean, people in terms of Pakistani refugees come from all across Pakistan. Some of them are Shia refugees, others are political dissidents, gender persecution, sort of all across the board. So they face, you know, back in Pakistan, they all face pretty much different situations, but similar in the sense that they all face danger. They're all facing some form of persecution. And the situation in Pakistan right now is quite horrific. There's a strike in Karachi. Karachi's under siege. There's curfew in Karachi. Yesterday, there was a shootout of 10 army members in Karachi yesterday. The week before that, there was a suicide bombing. All of May has been horrific in terms of Karachi and Lahore. There's been a series of suicide bombings that have been escalating over time in Karachi in the past month, and obviously so much of that has to do with the war on terrorism, the increasing sectarianism, militarization of South Asia and the region in general.
The issue of sectarian violence is an important one to a lot of the refugees here. Maybe you could elaborate a bit more on what Shia Muslims are facing right now in cities, as you mentioned, like Karachi and Lahore.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the Shia refugees specifically, again, just to pinpoint that they're not all of the refugees in Pakistan, but they are a huge section of the refugees, like you were mentioning. What they're facing is, I don't know, in terms of historically, the Sipe Sahaba, which is a very militant Sunni supremacist organization, and they target not only Shias, they target mostly Shias, but they are also targeting Christian minorities, the Ahmadi minorities as well. They came to rise, and it's important to talk about it in the context of U.S. foreign policy that's been going on since the 70s, in the sense that the Sipe Sahaba gained a lot of prominence and gained a lot of funding during the 70s and 80s when General Zia-ul-Huq, who was a military dictator in Pakistan, who he himself was propped up due to U.S. imperialist policy, because at that time the war between Iran and Iraq had started in the late 70s, early 80s. And then after that, there was also the Afghani-Soviet war. So at the same time, as Zia-ul-Huq, when he first took over power in Pakistan, he obviously wasn't very popular. And he was almost out, in the sense that there was a lot of popular resistance against him. And the economy was in a bad state, all of that. People were calling for elections. And then he was given a huge, huge boost by the U.S., who's pumped in a whole bunch of money into Pakistan in the form of close to $2.2 billion during the 70s and 80s to support Zia. And part of that was supporting the SSP. So the sectarian violence in Pakistan is a very, very recent phenomenon. It's only about 30 years old. Sort of half of Pakistan's history has been marred by it, and it's closely linked to the U.S. foreign policy in terms of propping up, the Iran-Iraq resistance, which was the Iraqis, Sunni resistance against Iraq, against Iran, which was directly linked to, the U.S. worrying about the Shia uprising in Iraq and Iran, and the same thing in Soviet-occupied Afghanistan. So a lot of that has been because of U.S. foreign policy that started in the 70s, and then obviously with the war on terrorism, the U.S. in the past 2 years alone has given, pumped in terms of military endowments, over $3.2 billion into Pakistan in the past 3 years. But it's also interesting because now governments of Pakistan that used to depend on religious organizations, depended on very militant sectarianism in the country to sort of divide and rule throughout their time there, is now faced with sectarianism that they can't control, because you have Islamist organizations, whether sectarian or mainstream, who oppose the war on terrorism and oppose Pakistan's role in the war on terrorism. So now you have a situation that's very similar to Afghanistan, where the U.S. is facing President Musharraf, who basically can't control the SSP, who is essentially their own creation, right? So it's a very similar situation. And the violence has been increasing over the past year, because again, you have a situation which people cannot control. Technically, President Musharraf outlawed the SSP a year ago, but again, it's police and state inaction essentially have led to an even greater escalation of violence, because now the SSP is technically a banned organization. So sort of the grassroots militants within the organization are escalating their warfare against minorities across the board.
They still have a presence.
It's a national network. Yeah, they have an increasing presence. And 30 members of the SSP were detained approximately a year ago, but they were released 2 days later. And that's the main challenge that a lot of the Pakistani refugees face, because on the face of it, you have Immigration Refugee Board judges who tell them that the situation in Pakistan is safe now. You know, the U.S. or Pakistan is an ally in the war on terrorism. It's a safe country. Sectarianism doesn't exist. We've outlawed these types of organizations, but they know it's not true. In the case of Shamim Akhtar, for example, the woman we're talking about, her family, the judge quoted from a human right, very selectively, and, you know, very obvious racism and hypocrisy is apparent because she cited from the IRB's own reports, because the IRB uses Human Rights Watch and U.S. State Department reports as their own reports, and she cites a report which says, so she quotes, she chose to cite a section that said, you know, President Musharraf has outlawed the SSP, order has been restored, and the very next sentence of their own report says, however, on the ground it hasn't made any effects because the SSP is stronger than ever, the violence in the past 3 years is greater now than it's ever been, and there's a threat to people's lives, and, you know, there's been an upsurge in violence specifically in Karachi and Lahore, and she completely chose to ignore that aspect.
What is the Action Committee Against the Racial Profiling of Pakistani Refugees?
It's a committee that started up approximately 1 year ago now, over 1 year ago, and you know, self-organized Action Committee of Pakistani Refugees, because essentially people were realizing that everyone was being deported. You know, people were coming together the way the IRB tries to obviously make people feel like they're individual, like they're saying something wrong, the whole attitude of the IRB being, you know, you're guilty before you're proven innocent, trying to individualize people's cases, making them feel like they personally were not credible, even though across the board we know that the IRB rejects, you know, about 70 to 80% of Pakistani refugees. So they started to realize that the more that they were speaking with each other, the more that they realized that it was a crisis, that people were being handed out death sentences on a daily basis, being deported back, people fearing for their lives, that they came together. And the first demonstration they did is still probably one of the strongest ones. There was over 600 families at the first rally that they held about a year ago. But since then, they've been self-organizing. There's an office space that they have. It's the Refugee Protection Center. And, you know, again, the Pakistani refugees come from a wide spectrum of the communities in Pakistan themselves. Some are religious minorities, political dissidents, you know, people, a lot of women facing gender persecution. Across the board, different communities in Pakistan make up the Action Committee of Pakistani refugees. They've been some major, major victories. The Pakistani committee has had a lot of barriers that have been sort of, you know, a different situation than the Algerians and the Palestinians, in the sense that there are deportations constantly, which is very different than the Algerian situation was, and then the Palestinian situation, because there's deportations all the time. So they face, you know, most of the work has been very, very urgent casework. And there's been major victories, like Dawood Khan, the musician, whose deportation was stayed, Bilkis Fatima, which was last year, the Pakistani elderly woman who was in detention for over 4 months. So the Action Committee is very, very active in working within the community and self-organizing, fighting Citizenship and Immigration Canada, raising public awareness, and fighting for their rights, because, you know, essentially they're at the point where people are being deported back to death, and there's no doubt about it, whether it's Karachi, Lahore, Quetta, anywhere in Pakistan.
What has your work with Shamim Akhtar and her family been like?
Well, Shamim's actually one of the core members of the Action Committee, so for those of us who've been working with her, we've known her for 2 years, because one of the things about, you know, the concept of the refugee self-organizing is that a lot of them were active even before they were facing deportation. So Shamim's been active for 2 years fighting for everyone else, and now it's, you know, essentially everyone else needs to fight for her because her life's on the line. What it's like, I mean, I can't even, you know, the family's an incredible family. They're very loving for people who have met them. They're very, very close. They're willing, you know, it's a family that's willing to fight for each other, fight for their lives, essentially. You know, she's not willing to see her children be killed in a country that they fled from. Her children, before they fled from Pakistan, her children were held at gunpoint before they went into hiding. So, you know, the need to protect their family and their community is very fierce. And in terms of all the rest of us who are trying to do the same kind of work, we feel that very strongly. It's very evident that they're fighting tooth and nail to just survive and, you know, just making sure that they're alive at the very least.
Given the fact that her family has tried so hard to integrate themselves into Canadian society, and that, as you mentioned before, when the judge was looking at the human rights report and saw very clearly that this family It will face considerable danger if they sent back. What kind of message do you feel that Immigration Canada is sending out in a way by deporting this family?
There's no doubt Immigration and Refugee Board is incredibly racist. Well, if you have refugees who are, at several levels, refugees are treated as if though they're guilty, as if though they're making up stories, as if though they're trying to stay in Canada for no reason. I mean, everyone has a reason if they're uprooting themselves from their family, their lives, whether it's, whether it's war, whether it's persecution, whether it's poverty. It's racist in that way. It's racist in terms of IRB judges who are political appointees, and political appointees essentially enforce the political agenda of the government, which is currently, in terms of Pakistan and the South Asian region, the political arm of Canada is closely tied to Pakistan, is very closely tied to the Musharraf government. And in that sense, it's very clear that by sending the message that Pakistani refugees need to be deported, it's a very clear link in terms of making sure that Canada believes that Pakistan is safe. There's no doubt that there's an increase in terms of deportations of Arab, Muslim, and South Asian refugees, and it's a clear message that the lives of people who aren't white is definitely irrelevant to people, right? I mean, who cares what happens in the third world, whether it's directly in the third world or people who come from the third world, their lives become unimportant, Technically in Canada, we don't believe in capital punishment, but you have refugees' lives who are on the line every single day.
Finally, I had a chance to speak with Saraf Ali Khan. Saraf is 17 years old and is the eldest daughter of Shamim Akhtar. She is a powerful speaker and a passionate activist for the cause of Pakistani refugees. Maybe explain the experience of having to leave home in Pakistan and come to North America.
It's a bad experience that we had. It's something that we never wanted to do, but we had to do because we were convinced to do so. And it's not only once that we have changed ourselves. It's like several times, even when we were in Pakistan, after every 20 or 15 days, we used to change our house or we used to change places because we weren't saved over there. And then we went to America. Over there, life seemed to be a little bit better than before. We were allowed to go out. No one used to say nothing. Suddenly, the 11th September thing took place, came to Canada, because we were unable to do our asylum over there because lawyers were asking a lot of money, and on top of that, the police was knocking door by door to ask people that, do you guys have paper or green card or something? If not, then they used to put them in detention or they used to take them to jail. We came over here, we did our case, and it was least expected that we are going to get refused because whatever we said, we were so satisfied that whatever we are giving, whatever we are saying is all true. They do not have any reason to refuse us, but actually our judge, she refused us on the basis that my father is not an active member and he's not he doesn't have any high class profession to be assassinated or to be killed in Pakistan. Only those who have some high class profession, those who are like lawyers or advocates, they are being killed over there. Not people like my dad. But it's just a bad experience coming over here and then getting refused. If they didn't want to take us as immigrants or as refugees, why did they let us enter? Why did they give us a chance to start a life all over again? They just showed us a little beam of light and then suddenly they took it away.
What do you feel some of the dangers could be if you went back to Pakistan at the end of the month?
I know people who are being killed in Pakistan. I know their names and I know where they belong from because they are from our society, and Shia Muslims are really minority in Pakistan. And in Karachi, there, I know the Imam Bargas over there. And it's something that it's really important to us because my dad, he was really prominent over there. And that's why we are always worried about going back to Pakistan, because I know what's going to happen over there. If we leave, I know what's going to happen. How are they going to receive us over there? What are they going to ask us as questions? And all those incidents took place was nearly by my house where we used to live. And in 1 month, 65 people died. I'm like, in May, it's horrible. And there weren't even those people who were having high-class professions, or they were lawyers or doctors. They were kids for 3 years, 1 year old, 2 years old, 16, 17 of my age, too.
Did you find it hard to get comfortable here?
Just the language was hard, but my mom, she told me, okay, yeah, you have to live over here. Then we have to change the way we used to go out or stuff. It's really to integrate yourself in a life of Canadian people, and that's what we did. I'm like, and suddenly it's like, it was really, we cannot say that it was hard, but it was really new and really strange for us, and it was, well, we tried. I'm like, I speak French, my brother and my sister, she speaks French, he speaks French. It's just that we are well integrated over here. And instead of accepting us, we never gave them any chance to say that, okay, here you were like, you know, these are your weak points, or these are such things for which you can refuse you. They just refuse us for no basis, for no reasons.
How about your little brothers and sister? How do you think the experience has been for them?
I really don't know, but every time, like, they're just like my friends to me, and whenever we talk, it's only about this thing, and it's like, it's getting on their nerves. They cannot take it either. My exams are near. It's getting on my nerves, too. I'm not able to prepare my exams. I'm not able to do nothing. I'm not able to study. I have to work hard and hard for hours and hours. I have to sit. Even my brother and sister, they cannot concentrate. Neither can I, because what should we do? Should we pack our luggage? Should we go to the lawyer? Should we ask for the appeal? Should we run for the demonstrations? Or should we go to school? Or should we go to the library to study?
I mean, as you just mentioned, you're in school right now. How has your school responded to this deportation order?
Well, my teacher, she was really, really tense. She didn't want me to leave, and she's like, she's just tense. My classmates, they were crying a lot. I'm like, some of my friends, they cried a lot. They didn't want me to leave. I'm like, they're good with me. They're nice with me. Because I never gave them any chance. I'm like, these are the things which really one should count, but...
Do you feel that the judge's decision to deny you refugee status was founded in any way, or do you feel it was fair?
Well, yeah, she made a mistake because she wasn't supposed to do that. Just because of my father wasn't an active member, she said herself that I know that your dad is a Shia Muslim. I know that you guys are Shia Muslim, but he's not an active member. I'm like, how can she refuse us only on those bases? She just refuses. I'm like, I'm not afraid to say that because I know that's the truth. That she just refuses because she's well known for refusing people. She have never accepted no one, and that's maybe that's why she's like, you know, once in a golden moon she have accepted a case, and that's what she's well known for, because maybe they really, like, you know, they really sound good to her, probably, or she just felt like, you know, pity for them. That's really bad. She just seemed to be so nice from outside, and then suddenly, like, you know, it's just unimaginable that how can she do that to us. It's really unimaginable on refusing someone on reasons which doesn't have any sense, doesn't make any sense. Like, that's really stupid, and I'm not afraid to say that she refuses because she is well known to refuse people. And just to keep her honor, keep her standard, always there, she did that. I'm like, it wasn't a big deal for her, refusing someone. She just didn't thought that she's making a decision for six lives. She thought that she's closing a file now.
What have you and your family been doing to fight this deportation order? I know you've been fairly active.
Well, we are organizing a demonstration. There are such other things going on. It's an appeal that we are doing, a judicial appeal. And I'm not really saying that I'm counting on it, but it's like every single thing is being a hope for us. It's really, really important, because every chance we are taking, it's just for our lives. I'm like, no one is going to pay on our place. So that's why we're just, like, you know, paying attention, more attention on our case and on demonstrations. And whatever we can do to reach such people who can help us out, like Jack Sarah or anyone from the MPs or something, just trying our best.
What can other people do here in Montreal, or other people listening to this radio report, what can they do to help you and your family fight this deportation order?
Well, I would just like to pass this message that they should keep this in mind, that it's not the matter of a file which is going to be closed and of six people which the Canada will be losing soon, or a place that we will be leaving soon, or someone is going to be renting the house or something like that. It's just a matter of six lives. I'm like, I have a small brother who's just 2 years old. I cannot see my brother. There was this family who was gunshot back in Pakistan, and the baby was just 1 year old, and they shot her in her head. A guy was 16 years old, and they shot her in his mouth. I'm like, I'm really scared. I'm just 16 years. I just turned 17, and I'm just seeing that everything happening. Slowly, slowly, they're poisoning us without taking any blame on themselves. I would just like them, people over here, to help us out, to just, like, you know, to take a voice out for us, because no one will see their own kids dying in front of them, but my parents, they have to. They cannot do nothing. Even legally or illegally, we are just convinced to go back. States, they are not going to keep us over there. For sure, they are not going to keep us over there. And even if they are going to keep us over there, for how long? For 4 months? For 6 months? Nothing more than this. I would just like them to help us out, to sign papers for us, to find some way, to take a voice out, to just help us in demonstration or to do something. In any way they can help us out. Just raise a hand for us that, yeah, they are with us. Probably that's going to encourage us. Something like that's all I can ask them.
If you wish to get involved to help Shamim Akhtar and other refugees facing deportation, or for more information, you can contact the Action Committee Against Racial Profiling of Pakistani Refugees at 514-244-2461, or by emailing noii-montreal@resist.ca. This piece has been produced for the CKUT Community News Collective in Montreal by Aaron Lakoff.